afternoon. The case scheduled for argument this afternoon is Paul Erickson versus Stephen Moat. And we have Mr. Iskowich.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mr. Gorman. My name is David Iskowich with the Office of the Attorney General here in Chicago. This is a habeas corpus case, capital case, which has its origins in the Illinois State Court over 20 years ago. In the late summer of 1982, the petitioner, Paul Erickson, raped and murdered a 15-year-old girl in the Chicago suburbs, was subsequently caught, tried by a jury, convicted of murder and rape, among other offenses, waived the jury for sentencing purposes, and was sentenced to death. Petitioner appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court, as was his right. The Illinois Supreme Court affirmed. Petitioner sought post-conviction relief under Illinois law. That petition was denied. The petitioner appealed that to the Illinois Supreme Court, and among the claims he raised in that proceeding in that court were an ineffective assistance of counsel claim for failure to investigate and procure further evidence and mitigation for capital sentencing purposes, and he raised a counterpart claim that his attorney was ineffective for procuring and using the testimony of John Malisco, who it turns out on direct cross-examination by the state had falsified his credentials as to his professional training as a psychologist.
Mr. Iskowich,
yes, Your Honor.
Might this be the type of situation that the Supreme Court alluded to in United States versus Chronic, where counsel's performance was so wanting, so hideously wanting, as to amount to no assistance of counsel at all?
I would say that that's not the case here, Your Honor. In Chronic, the United States Supreme Court defined the situation at issue as one where the adversarial process was completely jeopardized.
Well, what affirmative steps did Mr. Erickson's counsel take to prepare for the sentencing hearing? Did he do any type of investigation into mitigating evidence?
We had John Malisco, Your Honor, who was hired by the parents of the petitioner to provide counseling services. I believe his attorney, Vishny, and the other gentleman talked to Mr. Malisco. He assured them that he would testify in mitigation, and he did so testify in the trial court.
Did trial counsel even read Mr. Walisco's report before he put Mr. Walisco on the stand?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, I think that's part of the record, is it not?
It should be, Your Honor. I can't recall off the top of my head.
That he did not?
I think
is it fair to say that the only thing he did was allow Walisco to examine Mr. Erickson and prepare a report?
That's what he did, and Mr. Walisco did examine Mr. Erickson for some 9 hours, took down his family history, noted his drug and alcohol abuse, his childhood growing up, and did present that in mitigation. I think it bears noting here that the Illinois Supreme Court on two occasions recognized this at sentencing. They acknowledged it. The trial court acknowledged it. The trial court looked at this mitigation evidence as mitigation evidence. I think it bears noting, especially in habeas proceedings, that where in collateral review, Your Honor, that the Illinois Supreme Court's opinion adequately dealt with this problem by reference to the vast array of aggravating evidence and a clear rejection of the hypothetical proposed mitigation evidence which his attorneys procured in post-conviction proceedings. It's very clear in Erickson 2, the appeal from his first post-conviction petition, that the Illinois Supreme Court examined in detail the affidavits provided by Drs. Randall and Fisher, who provided reports detailing certain psychological maladies that the petitioner supposedly had. The petitioner was bumped on his head several times. The petitioner might have been dropped on his head when he was a baby, all of which, in their opinion, rose to the level of the statutory mitigating factor.
Well, can we say that Erickson had the benefit of any advocacy at all?
Certainly he did, Your Honor. I cannot concede that point, and I don't think that the Illinois Supreme Court saw it that way either. The petitioner did raise a Chronic claim. That was rejected out of hand. What he did receive in the Illinois Supreme Court on three occasions was a detailed review of the trial. The aggravation evidence, which the petitioner seems to disregard to a large extent throughout this briefing process and in the district court, in which the district judge seemed not to really even pay much attention to in its application of the Strickland prejudice prong, was completely overwhelming. And the petitioner's actions on the night of the crime in question belie any subsequent expert opinion that he was acting under any sort of severe emotional or mental duress. The petitioner methodically planned and charted the course of action in August of 1982 to isolate, bind, gag, rape, and stab to death a 15-year-old girl. Any notion subsequent to trial that any sort of mitigation evidence of the sort which petitioner has now raised would have changed the outcome of that trial is preposterous. The district court went on to consider and excoriate the Illinois Supreme Court in Erickson 3 for refusing to consider in its Strickland prejudice analysis the report provided by Dr. Gelbort. In Erickson 2, which again was the first post-conviction appeal, the petitioner appended to his report, as I stated earlier, to his petition, excuse me, as I referred to earlier, reports tendered by Drs. Randall and Fisher. In Erickson 3, the petitioner sought to relitigate this claim, essentially with a new affidavit from a Dr. Gelbort. The Illinois Supreme Court exercised this very well-practiced rule of res judicata under state law and said, Mr. Petitioner, you can't come back here with this claim. It's the exact same claim. You're attempting to evade the procedural bar by simply appending an additional claim, additional affidavit, which you had absolutely every chance to do in post-conviction one. The district court went on to criticize the Illinois Supreme Court and hold its application of Strickland unreasonable because it didn't consider the totality of mitigation evidence, when in fact it did consider the totality of properly pled mitigation evidence tendered in the first post-conviction proceedings. The district court's reading of Erickson 2 and Erickson 3 is completely strained and inflexible and does not warrant habeas relief in this instance.
Do you want to talk about the jury waiver?
Certainly, Your Honor, if you'd like me to.
Particularly in view of the trial judge's inaccurate and confusing statement as to jury unanimity vis-a-vis imposition of the death penalty. I mean, when questioned Mr. Erickson about the jury waiver, the trial judge told him that a sentencing jury's decision whether or not to impose the death penalty would have to be unanimous, just like the decision as to his guilt or innocence. In view of the judge's analogy to the guilt-innocent determination, wouldn't it have been reasonable for Mr. Erickson to think that he would need the votes of all 12 jurors in order to avoid the death penalty, when in fact, he only needed one?
I understand your question, Your Honor. I respectfully must disagree with you. Again, the record shows that after the first admonition which the trial court gave to the petitioner, which the petitioner has seized upon in habeas proceedings and in the courts of the Illinois, that the instruction was, or admonition was unclear, the trial court went on to say, and the petitioner seems to ignore this clarification, that all 12 jurors must conclude.
No, they didn't ignore that. But that statement simply reaffirmed the principle that you need all 12 jurors to agree before the death sentence could be imposed. But what did that statement do? Okay, the statement that all 12 jurors must conclude that the punishment should be death before the death penalty could be imposed in this case. What did that statement do to clear up the confusion about what happens if the jury is divided on the question of death?
That question seems to me, Your Honor, to be clearly answered by the statement that all 12 jurors must agree on the death sentence. It follows that if all 12 jurors must agree on whether to sentence the petitioner to death, one juror voting against the death sentence will preclude the death sentence in that instance. And this court in Todd versus Shomig, which was recently decided, held that the admonition that all 12 jurors would have to agree on the death penalty was sufficient. And I also might note that the United States Supreme Court has never held that the one juror, so-called one juror rule, is governing federal law. To the extent the court believes that, I don't mean to interrupt, Your Honor, but to the extent the court believes that the statement was somehow unclear, I'd simply refer the court to that statement and clarification.
I mean, lay people understand the principle that a hung jury only gets you a new trial, not an acquittal. The judge's remarks suggest that the same principle applies to capital sentencing, when in fact a divided jury would have spared Mr. Erickson from the death penalty.
Well, Your Honor, in that second...
Well, you quote, pardon me for interrupting.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The quote, I believe you're talking about occurs. You understand it means that the verdicts in the case of determining whether or not the death penalty would be imposed must be unanimous. This is a verdict your guilt or innocence be imposed. That means all 12 jurors must conclude that the punishment should be death before the death penalty could be imposed in this case. That's what was said, wasn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. That was said in the record to the petitioner by the trial court. And if I might, I don't mean to parrot myself here, but that second clarifying remark certainly cured any...
It came immediately following the earlier statement. That was
absolutely, came right after it.
And in the event you waive your right to have a jury, then there would be only one person who would make that determination.
Correct. That came immediately following that.
I understand,
it
yes.
It was
asked yes.
if he understood and he responded in the affirmative.
That accurate statement of law following that totally inaccurate misinformation, affirmative misinformation, did nothing, in my view, to remedy the misconception that's conveyed by the judge's previous remark.
Well, as long as we're ruling on it from the bench, I'll say it. It convinced me, so go ahead.
He was misled by the judge's advice, and his attorney did not independently correct the misimpression. And what?
Your Honor, I don't want to interrupt. I'm sorry. I might note that the Illinois Supreme Court also addressed this issue in some detail.
Well, Mr. Erickson has indicated that he was misled by the trial judge's remarks need for unanimity in the sentencing jury's decision, and that he would not have waived a jury had he not been misled. Is there any evidence in the record that would give us reason to doubt Mr. Erickson's assertions on these points?
Nothing in the record that I would know except his assertion after the fact that he was sentenced to death by the trial court, which I think speaks volumes, Your Honor.
Didn't he also say that his attorney thought that there would be a better chance?
Correct, Your Honor. Now, that brings up a good point in that, having just been convicted by a jury of his peers of this senseless murder, waiving the same jury is something that is to be desired. And I believe this court in Tenor versus Gilmore stated that even a convicted murderer can fall to even further depths in the eyes of a jury, and that under such circumstances, such decisions are wisely made. I might also like to touch upon the district court's second ground for granting habeas in this case, which was a factual finding question. Under the AEDPA, the facts developed in the state courts must be presumed to be correct unless the petitioner can show with clear and convincing evidence to the contrary. The district court criticized the Illinois Supreme Court for making supposedly contradictory findings of fact related to the import of John Wolitzko's testimony. The petitioner in Erickson 3 raised the claim that the testimony of John Wolitzko was actually aggravating, didn't help his case, wasn't mitigating at all. And the Illinois Supreme Court found that, yes, it was mitigating, and that it did not contribute to the trial court's sentencing decision. Now, in this part of its opinion, the Illinois Supreme Court was addressing the petitioner's assertion that it was indeed aggravating evidence, and said, as I just said, that it did not contribute to the sentencing court's decision. In other words, it didn't contribute to the trial court's overall review of the evidence in aggravation. And it went on to say in the next paragraph that the trial court did conduct a review of the Willisco testimony in aggravation. And the record is borne, this conclusion drawn by the Illinois Supreme Court is borne by the trial record, which shows that the trial court did indeed consider Mr. Willisco's testimony in its review of mitigation in the case, and that simply because the mitigation evidence tendered there, and simply because the mitigation evidence tendered by petitioner in subsequent post-conviction proceedings was not adequate to save him from the death sentence, simply because the petitioner believed that this could have saved him at sentencing didn't mean that it was sufficient to preclude the death sentence in this instance. Again, in light of the aggravating evidence, which was adduced at the sentencing hearing, those statements made by the Illinois Supreme Court were not, in fact, contradictory, are borne out by the record, and did not afford the district court with the power to grant habeas relief for the petitioner's death sentence.
As I understand it, the witness and the witnesses having to do with his mental status came only in sentencing, not during the trial itself. Am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that the persons who hired the mitigating doctor were the parents of the...
That's correct, Your Honor.
Do I also recall Illinois law still says that a layperson can give opinion as to the mental status or mental condition of the opinion as to whether or not he thinks they're insane,
correct,
insane or otherwise.
That is correct. And the trial court did acknowledge that Mr. Willisco had falsified his credentials.
So not as an expert witness, but as an observer witness who had some expertise in the field, whether it's obtained in college level or obtained in practice.
Correct.
Did he have a private practice?
He had some sort of counseling practice, I believe.
In where? What town?
Chicago, I believe. Yes, Illinois law does hold that a lay testimony can be as effective as expert testimony.
Lay testimony from a psychotic liar.
That's how Your Honor wants to characterize the gentleman. That's okay. If there are any further questions from the panel, I would respectfully reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
I have a couple. One is, as far as this, the statutory standard, extreme emotion, was it
extreme emotional distress.
Disturbance. Is that a medical or a legal standard?
It's a legal standard. The standard is, it's not as high a standard to provide a defense to murder, but it is a legal standard to be weighed by a jury.
In the two, or actually all three reports, at least two of them come up with that very verbiage saying that he was suffering from this condition. Well, this is just from the affidavit of Dr. Fisher. He says, I determined that Mr. Erickson was under extreme mental and emotional distress for some time, including on July 30th, 1982.
Correct. He did say that.
Is this condition, legal or medical? I assume he's giving a medical opinion, even though it's a legal definition. Is this condition something that can last, as he puts it, for some time? He was talking about the factors including the deep-seated need for to please individuals much younger than himself and appear to be cool, his habitual use of alcohol, and the fact that he had ingested a significant amount of hard liquor that evening, a history of head trauma, the fact that Mr. Erickson was never convicted of anything similarly. But he indicates that this is over a period of time, and the reason I ask that because the Illinois Supreme Court has said that, and more recently than this case, a defendant is under the influence of an extreme emotional disturbance when the defendant's emotional state at the time of the murder is at such a fragile point as to leave him or her with little or no emotional control. That's how they define this.
Right.
Now that, I assume, is the legal definition
right.
of this standard.
Correct. I might just note very briefly that...
We've had a lot of questions, so don't worry about your
problem. Okay, Your Honor, thank you very much. I appreciate that. As far as those reports are concerned, significantly, neither expert reviewed the trial transcript in this case, which gave the best picture of exactly what was going on in 1982.
I assume where he says, I did not review the entire transcript because, in my expert opinion, the statement of witnesses, et cetera, were not relevant or reliable basis for assessing his psychological condition. So I assume he's, again, looking at a medical condition as opposed to a legal one.
The Illinois Supreme Court found it astounding that such conclusions can be reached by mere interview years and years after the fact, and that the facts of the crime belie any notion that this petitioner was acting under any sort of duress, given his planned and very cold premeditation of the crime. If Your Honors...
I'd like to clarify something. I think I used the word pathological error. I mean, psychotic error. I meant to say pathologic.
Okay,
liar.
Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll get some time for rebuttal. Mr. Gorman?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Eric Gorman of Skadden Arps on behalf of Paul Erickson, who is the appellee and the cross-appellant in this case. Your Honors, the District Court correctly granted relief in this case for constitutional errors that occurred in what was an extremely unusual, in fact, extraordinarily strange sentencing hearing. This is that rare case where a defense lawyer's errors are so egregious, so serious, and so undermine the defense that the defendant's entitled to a new sentencing hearing. And that's exactly what the District Court held. Counsel's errors in this case mean that Paul Erickson never actually had his day in court when it came to sentencing. Specifically, defense counsel never checked the credentials, as the record clearly shows, never checked the credentials of his only witness at sentencing, John Velichko, who turned out to be a confidence man, who was later convicted by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Illinois. Counsel never investigated, never presented the available mitigation evidence on Mr. Erickson's behalf, and instead, what counsel presented was Velichko's fraudulent, completely incompetent, and aggravating, and that's the key, aggravating testimony against Paul Erickson.
You know, well, I'm curious to ask you pretty much the same question that I asked Mr. Iskowich, which is whether the performance of Mr. Erickson's counsel was so wanting to amount to the constructive denial of counsel, you know, pursuant to the Supreme Court's opinion in Chronic. You pointed out in your brief, as you are now, you know, the many omissions in his attorney's performance. But did his attorney do enough so that we have to find prejudice under Strickland before we grant relief? Or is this one of those rare occasions where the attorney's performance is so deficient that we really can presume prejudice under Chronic?
Your Honor, I think we in fact argued that to the District Court below, and the District Court decided to grant relief under the basis of Strickland, under the unreasonable application of Strickland by the Illinois Supreme Court. However, I think Your Honor is exactly right. I think that Chronic would be an alternative basis for granting relief in this case. However, what we're asking this court to do is to grant under Strickland. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has recently spoken to the Chronic standard and has limited it to a severely limited, in effect. The presumed prejudice standard, that is. And with that in mind, what we're asking this court to do is affirm the District Court on the basis of Strickland. But however, we think that the argument is absolutely right. Counsel's performance in this case was actually worse than an omission. It was actually favorable to the state, because what Mr. Velichko testified to was that Paul Erickson, I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought.
He suffered from extreme emotional and
No.
That's true.
Dr. Fisher. John Wolitschko never said that. In fact, what Wolitschko said, and as the Illinois Supreme Court said in Erickson 3, Wolitschko's opinion and characterization of Paul Erickson was, in fact, negative and might not have helped the defense.
Well, is it positive to say that you're suffering from extreme emotional and whatever it is, stress, disturbance?
Well, it's a statutory mitigating factor, Your Honor.
That's what everybody's trying to establish here, or at least I guess that's what the affidavits would establish. And I thought, in his own maybe inept way, that's what Paul, what's his name, was trying to do.
John Wolitschko.
What's his name?
John Wolitschko, I believe it's.
Easy to go by first name, I can't.
I think, Your Honor, that's a point that the state attempts to make in their brief, and certainly on oral argument, the state attempts to make that claim. However, I believe that if the court will look at the plain language, a simple plain language analysis of Wolitschko's testimony and his report, which counsel never bothered to review in advance, as Judge Roebern pointed out, this is something that is so aggravating on its face that there's no debate. In fact, that's why, in fact, the Illinois Supreme Court held that and found that, as a matter of fact, that Wolitschko's testimony and his opinions about the defendant in this case were negative. And that's actually a finding of fact that we think if the court will, you know, be providing any deference at all to the Illinois Supreme Court, that's a fact that ought to be deferred to.
Well, what about the difference between mitigating and aggravating? The Supreme Court, at least I thought, indicated, and I thought maybe the district court had that wrong, is that it was considered only in the mitigating aspect as opposed to aggravating.
The state strives mightily to make this distinction and say it was only considered for mitigation. In fact, there's no question that the sentencing judge considered John Wolitschko's testimony. In fact, two pages in the transcript, in the trial transcript, before the sentencing judge imposes the death penalty on Paul Erickson, he actually buys Wolitschko's incompetent and completely false testimony about Erickson's upbringing, hook, line, and sinker. And what he says is that, in the transcript, the sentencing judge says that Mr. Erickson grew up in an ideal home. He had good parents. He had music lessons and all the other sort of good things that kids in the suburbs have. And yet still, here's where he ends up. But what the
That's
sentencing judge...
That's kind of where Fisher came out, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't that where Fisher came out?
No, Your Honor. Dr. Fisher and Dr. Randall both testify at length about the psychologically abusive upbringing that Mr. Erickson suffered through. In fact...
Well, they were highly critical of the mother, but I thought all of those other things that you just mentioned, you know, the Catholic grade school, you know, his at least average grades, that he did have piano and other music lessons, that he participated in baseball, did a lot of things that... and there was this abuse Erickson describes it as being patted on the rear end by a priest and other things. So I don't know why that is. When you talk about when you get Fisher and why they disregarded Fisher. Fisher, I assume you would endorse, at least, as far as what that report came out with.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Dr. Fisher's report is right on the money. And in fact, there's no dispute that it was properly before not only the district court, but it's also properly before the state courts. It was raised on the first post-conviction petition, and there's no dispute about it being properly before this court. And what Dr. Fisher actually writes and what Dr. Randall corroborates, and then Dr. Gelbort later on corroborates on the second post-conviction petition, is that Erickson had been sexually abused by a priest. He had actual physical damage to his brain, which manifested itself in a variety of cognitive problems, among other things. That Mr. Erickson had attempted to commit suicide when he was 13 years old, that Mr. Erickson had a long history of drug and alcohol abuse that contributed, all of which contributed to Mr. Erickson's actions on the night in question. And that's the evidence that the sentencing judge never had before him, because instead of allowing the defense to, now I'm getting into the continuance issue a little bit, but in fact, trial counsel's inability to actually
develop and find the available mitigating evidence and then present that evidence to the sentencing judge is exactly the problem here. And in its place, instead of doing that, what trial counsel did was he presented the aggravating testimony of John Wolitschko. And again, to come back to the Illinois Supreme Court has made a finding of fact that Wolitschko's characterization of Paul Erickson was negative. So what you have here in this case is you have aggravating evidence from the state and you have aggravating evidence from the defense. There is no evidence in the record before the sentencing judge on Mr. Erickson's behalf. There's none of the mitigation that the U.S. Supreme Court requires any court to consider in a capital sentencing proceeding. And as a result of that, where we think we are, what we would submit that is the one of the determinative cases in this litigation would be the Emerson versus Gramley case. And that's a case in which this court held that where a defense lawyer did nothing at the sentencing proceeding, presented no mitigating evidence whatsoever, on the instructions of his client, by the way, that was ineffective assistance of counsel, and it was not a case where the federal courts would come back and sort of balance the proposed mitigation and see, well, was it actually mitigating? Could it have been aggravating? Because some of it was very aggravating in that case. Here what we have is even worse than Emerson versus Gramley, where this court affirmed relief. Because here we have a case where the defense counsel actually presented aggravating evidence. He presented the evidence from Wolitschko. Wolitschko testified that Paul Erickson was a danger to people, that he had, in essence, committed a rape of his parents, where he had a grandiose sense of entitlement and self-importance. He was manipulative. A whole host of extremely aggravating characterizations, and really mischaracterizations, because none of this was competent evidence, of course. John Wolitschko was a complete and utter fraud, and in fact he was referred by the same state prosecutors who had, let me back up here, after Wolitschko testified at the sentencing hearing in this case, the state prosecutors turned around and referred him to the Illinois Department of Registration and Education for falsely holding himself out as a psychologist. The U.S. Attorney's Office prosecuted him, and he pled guilty to a whole series of different frauds, including lying to the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Northern District, and a number of other things that are detailed in the government's report in United States versus Wolitschko. And as the federal prosecutors lay out in very clear detail in the government's version in United States versus Wolitschko, this was truly a fraud on the Circuit Court of Cook County that was perpetrated by John Wolitschko. It was aggravating, it was fraudulent. As a result, there is no defense in this case, and that's all we're asking for at the end of the day. We're asking this court to give Mr. Erickson his day in court.
What about the Supreme Court of Illinois and the Strickland standard? Because I know that's where you are properly focusing your argument, and because they took a lot of this in consideration and concluded that these omissions were not prejudicial.
Your Honor, as the district court held, the way that the Illinois Supreme Court needed to look at counsel's performance and at whether there was any prejudice from counsel's performance in this case is you need to look at counsel's performance as a whole. And the Illinois Supreme Court refused to do that on two different occasions. The counsel's performance as a whole was not only the aggravating factor of introducing Wolitschko's aggravating testimony, which characterized the defendant negatively and actually characterized him as a danger to society, but it's also the opportunity cost, if you will, of having presented that evidence. And that's the evidence that a competent lawyer would have presented, but which counsel in this case did not present. And so what we have here is a consolidated whole, if you will, of the effect of counsel's performance. And the Illinois Supreme Court divided it up. It said on Erickson 2, we'll look at, on the first post-conviction petition, we will look only at the mitigation issues. We'll look at Fisher, we'll look at Randall, we'll look at the other mitigation evidence. We will, however, in Erickson 2, refuse to look at the Wolitschko errors. On Erickson 3, what the Illinois Supreme Court did was it looked at the Wilichko errors and refused to look at the mitigation errors. But it never put the two halves together into the whole that it is. And therefore,
they were looking at a race judicata issue, actually. If they had already decided the same issue raised then on, I guess you call it Erickson 3.
You're absolutely right. What the Illinois Supreme Court did in Erickson 3 is it held that the mitigation evidence was had already been litigated and it was decided on res judicata. That, however, is it's a function of two things. There are two issues, I think, going on here, Your Honor. First of all, we'd submit that the res judicata ruling is a merits ruling for purposes of habeas review, and we cite the case from the Seventh Circuit in our brief on that point. And so for that reason, because there is actually a merits ruling, res judicata being a merits ruling for purposes of 2254, that this court and the district court can consider all of that together. The second part is procedurally how the Illinois Supreme Court requires the evidence to be raised. Because whereas this court has a lengthy jurisprudence about the merits of raising an ineffectiveness claim on direct appeal, and that it's highly inadvisable to do so because you necessarily rely on information outside the record, the Illinois Supreme Court does it exactly the opposite if you take Erickson 1, 2, and 3. And what the Illinois Supreme Court required was that the issue be raised on the direct appeal, not on the first post-conviction petition. The Illinois Supreme Court's own procedural rules, however, cannot be a basis for avoiding the required prejudice analysis under Strickland. So even though the Illinois Supreme Court has its own rules about how things need to be raised and when they can be raised, and they certainly need to be respected, that doesn't preclude and that cannot prevent the Illinois courts from then looking at Strickland, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision, and looking at that analysis as required under Strickland. And that, again, requires the whole prejudice to be analyzed, both Wilichko and the mitigation on the other hand. And the Illinois Supreme Court refused two separate invitations to do that.
Well, what did they do in Erickson 3, then, where they acknowledged that this was the same appellate, the same counsel that did the first post-conviction? I guess that would be Erickson 2, and therefore they did consider Erickson 3, but since the Fisher and whatever the other name is, evidence was considered in Erickson 2, that's where they said, you know, even though they're allowing another bite at the apple or whatever you want to call it, they nevertheless did acknowledge that this had already been pretty fully examined, even though it was with the same counsel.
Your Honor, I think you're absolutely right. The Illinois Supreme Court held in Erickson 3 that the claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel was properly before the court, and it said so expressly. What the Illinois Supreme Court did not do, though, is ever allow Mr. Erickson a bite at the Strickland apple. And the Strickland apple, again, is the analysis that's set out and required not only by Strickland but also by Williams versus Taylor. And as the district court held, that requires the Illinois courts to look at the entirety of the effects of counsel's errors, both Wilichko and the lack of mitigation, because you've got the one and then you've got the opportunity cost of the one, which is the mitigation. And the Illinois Supreme Court's declined multiple opportunities to do that. So what is left in the case at the end of the day is we have a sentencing hearing at which no mitigation at all was presented. And again, that brings, respectfully, we would submit that brings this case back into the realm of Emerson versus Grambling. This is even worse. Mr. Erickson actually would have been lucky to have the lawyer in Emerson versus Grambling, we would submit.
Well, I guess you're saying that when the Illinois court looked at the two psychiatrists' reports and concluded that while it's interesting background, it probably indicates why he committed this, it's called a heinous type of crime, premeditated and, you know, a planned and forced rape and then murder and then subsequent evasion, trying to hide evidence in the body, etc. But all those facts in and of themselves were so overwhelming that whatever this long, detailed background, which is long and detailed, I admit, lots of interviews and things, was really just sort of evidence of, you know, we understand why he did it, but is that really, I think they just thought this was not mitigating to the extent that it gave some excuse. And I read earlier, I guess, I don't read it again, the what they define the extreme emotional distress, what the Supreme Court does. And it's supposed to be something that happens sort of, and I don't want to call it the spur of the moment, but there's, it's an exceptional condition as opposed to a long and still existing condition, according to one of those people.
The fragile emotional state, if Your Honor will, and that, I believe that that's Your Honor's own footnote that you cite
no,
to the Illinois Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court of Illinois.
But Your Honor, I believe Your Honor cites that case in the footnote.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's the issue here. Mr. Erickson was entitled to have a sentencer actually consider his defense, actually consider his mitigation. And he never had that. He never had his day in court. He never had the opportunity to have a sentencer actually sift through the evidence, both pro and con, and come up with a reasoned conclusion. And that's what the Constitution requires. Instead, he had aggravation both from the defense and from the state.
So
and
the
that's
finding
back
from
to
the Illinois Supreme Court isn't something we're obligated to.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We're not obligated to defer to this finding of the Illinois Supreme Court.
Your Honor, what we would contend is that this is an unreasonable application, in fact, of Strickland by the Illinois Supreme Court. So while the court is certainly required under 2254 to give appropriate deference, that deference only applies where the underlying opinion of the state court was, in fact, a reasonable application.
So that's the standard we have to apply, whether or not it was a reasonable application. I think that's what it comes down to.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it's both an unreasonable application, we think, of the law, Strickland, and Williams versus Taylor, but it's also an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the record evidence, because if Your Honors will look at the brief, and I see now that I'm
we're out of time, or close to it. We're not enforcing time. There's nobody waiting to come in here.
If Your Honors, and I certainly don't want to take up the court's time, but if Your Honors will look at the brief, at our brief, we lay out, I think, in with some degree of clarity, the ways in which the district court was right, because the sentencing judge expressly said he would rely on Wolitschko's characterization. And as the Illinois Supreme Court itself held in Erickson 3, that characterization was negative. Mr. Erickson never had his day in court again, and that's all we're asking for. So, if I may, and I'll wrap up unless there are no more questions. The relief we're seeking and the relief we obtained from the district court is simply a commonsensical, if you will, application of this court's clear precedence and the U.S. Supreme Court's clear precedence. We're not asking for you to issue a radical new sort of proposition of law. We're not asking you to swing open the doors of death row. We're not asking for even that you declare Mr. Erickson can't be sentenced to death. We're simply asking that Mr. Erickson have his day in court, and we'd ask that the district court be affirmed on that basis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Squitch.
May it please the court. Just a couple of brief comments, Your Honors. First, the petitioner claims that the Illinois Supreme Court in Erickson 2 didn't look at the Wolitschko claim. The reason they didn't look at the Wolitschko claim is because it was waived. It could have been raised on direct appeal. And the Illinois Supreme Court did look at the Wolitschko claim in Erickson 3. Under the view petitioner has seemingly subscribed to, the Illinois Supreme Court was obligated to review any and all mitigation evidence foisted upon it by the petitioner no matter what time it was done. The reason the Gelbort report was not considered was because the petitioner had a full and fair opportunity, protracted opportunities, to bring out whatever mitigation evidence he felt was necessary in Erickson 2. The petitioner argued as if no court has ever reviewed the Fisher and Randall reports. The Illinois Supreme Court gave it detailed treatment in Erickson 2, point by point, refuting each point in a detailed summary and referring the reader to the aggravation evidence.
Well, they say that just wasn't a reasonable application of Strickland when they reviewed that.
It was completely reasonable, Your Honor. It weighed the mitigation evidence tendered by the petitioner in post-conviction proceedings against what was arrayed in aggravation and concluded in a decision which cannot be called unreasonable that given the nature of this crime, there's no reasonable probability under Strickland that the result of the sentencing hearing would have been different. And to conclude, as the petitioner does, that in Erickson 3, the Illinois Supreme Court completely dropped the ball and forgot about its prior analysis in Erickson 2 and its res judicata holding again in Erickson 3, that somehow this deprived him of a fair opportunity to have a weighing of the totality of the mitigation and aggravation evidence, completely ignores Erickson 2, reads the two opinions in a vacuum, and is not what was intended by the AEDPA. If there's any further questions from the panel, the respondent would request that the district...
I'm just sitting here trying to remember Judge Manning's the point that she made when she said that the Illinois Supreme Court misapplied Strickland when it said it was unlikely the result would have been different but for trial's ineffectiveness, rather than stating that there was no reasonable possibility of a different outcome.
Correct, Your Honor. That, although the district court didn't ultimately grant relief on that point, it did express some concern under the contrary two-prong of the AEDPA, finding, seemingly, that the Illinois Supreme Court's usage of the term unlikely in lieu of reasonable probability was somehow contrary to Strickland. Again, with all due respect to the district court, this encompasses an entirely fractured reading of the opinion in which it cited to Strickland and its standard prior to that.
I think she ultimately acknowledged that.
She
did
acknowledge
the correct standard, which is why she didn't rely on the unlikely issue.
That's right, Your Honor. And I think she realized that to grant habeas relief on word usage under the circumstances would have been appropriate, hence her decision to grant under Section 2254, second prong. If there are no further questions, the respondent respectfully requests that this court affirm the decision of the district court as to the issues raised by petitioner, reverse its decision to grant habeas for the sentence of death, and remand with instructions for reinstatement of that sentence. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much, and thanks to both counsel for the excellent briefs and arguments. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until further notice.